5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Earth below us, drifting, falling, flow.
Welcome to AnnaZone 23, where we look at old anime, especially movies and OVAs. These are the films and projects that help shape the anime landscape as we know it today. We want to look at them in their own era and how they were the inspiration for many of the shows and franchises that are popular today. Some have become legends, while others have been deservedly forgotten. All of them, you should remind yourself, someone had to draw that. Thanks, Major Tom. Hello, and welcome to another episode of AnnaZone 23. I'm your host, Rick.
I'm Drew.
And on this week, we would actually like to submit an apology and a correction to our previous episode on Leji Matsumoto, where we talked about his early Legiverse. Well, there's one show that really, without the other shows, I don't believe would really, they wouldn't exist, at least not in the same form that they do as we know them. And that show is Uchen Senken Yamato, or as it's known in the West, Space Battleship Yamato. This was really one of the first big, if not the first big, am I correct in saying, Drew, that this is the first big space opera when it comes to anime, and pretty much every space opera that's come since owes itself to Yamato?
I would say it's the first real space opera. Because there's nary a giant robot in sight. It follows on to some degree from what they were doing in live action movies and a lot of joint productions with Hollywood. Things like The Green Slime and some other stuff that were getting turned out in Toho in the earlier parts of the decade. But
or you could you could even consider it kind of similar to Atragon from 63.
Yeah, or Atragon. Yeah, it. You have the MacGuffin ship bit, which, of course, which also probably ties in a bit of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, truth be told, although the story structure is not the same.
And another thing that's actually kind of interesting, since we're talking about it right away, so the name Yamato in the title, Space Battleship Yamato, comes from the Japanese Imperial Navy ship. It was the IGN. IGN was the prefix, right?
Japanese didn't have an official prefix.
That's right. They just called him the Yamato, which was also known, which is widely known as the world's largest battleship at the time. And officially, it's the world's largest battleship in history. Now, technically, there were several ships that were longer than the Yamato, but none of them came up to the total overall mass of the Yamato. It was very
the displacement was
heavy.
I think the Musashi might have been its sister ship might have actually been larger, but they're both of a very similar weight. They're both pushing near 70,000 up near around 70,000 tons fully loaded.
The largest battleships that the United States had at the time, the Iowas, I believe, maxed out in World War II about 65,000, correct?
Closer to 50.
Was it closer to 50?
Yeah. That was what was... There was a lot of argument going on during the war because they had lots of pictures of the Yamato that were taken by airplanes and various other things. And there was... People were measuring the photos and saying, it's a 65,000-ton battleship.
Apologies,
and there were a lot of intelligence analysts saying... No, you got to be missing something. It's probably 45,000 tons because the treaty limit originally for the treaty that had expired in 36 was limited battleships to 35,000 tons. That's the South Dakota class and the North Carolina class for the U.S.
For those of you who do not speak military history, the Iowas were the battleships that you may have remember from the 90s that were involved in the Gulf War. They were reactivated in the I believe it was in the late 70s, early 80s.
Early
80s. Part of Reagan's 400 ship, no 600 ship Navy initiative. Yeah. And they were about fully loaded during that time. They were 61,000 tons, but that's from all the additions of missiles and radar and stuff that they didn't have in World War II.
Yeah, It's, and remember, displacement, it depends on how much oil
stuff's on board.
Stuff is.
But anyways,
in any case, there was an agreement that a lot of analysts said, no, it's a 45,000 tonner because 45,000 is the general size class that anybody who went past the treaty seemed to fetch up on. The Bismarck was about 45,000 tons. The Hood, which had been built in World War One, was about in that area, and the Iowas were in that area. Because that was, I guess when you start doing scaling things up, that's the next size limit where the math makes sense. Well, the Japanese had skipped an entire step and built these. They planned to build initially four enormous battleships. They finished two as battleships and one as an aircraft carrier, and none of them survived the war.
But digressing from our little military history sidetrack there, it is kind of important because the historical Yamato in the original show is basically, you'll notice something, especially if you're familiar with like Gundam or several of the other, many other sci-fi anime series that have come since then. They have this general look of surface warships in space. Shows like Gundam, Irresponsible Captain Tyler, just to name a few. Where they don't have, we're used to in the West, we're used to either ships that they look like Star Destroyers and the ships from Star Wars, or they look like the ships from Star Trek, where either they're kind of like the Federation design or more of like the bird type spaceships, which you could see a lot of times when they did spaceships in some of the Hanna-Barbera, like Space Ghost had kind of a bird shaped, spaceship. But it was kind of unique. Yamato sort of started that idea where basically, hey, let's just take what we know, which is, World War II battleships, and slap rockets on them and put them in space. That's pretty much all they did for the mechanical design of the ships. Yes.
The bad guy ships kind of look like a cross between a pill bug, an old tumble home destroyer, and a few other things. They're a real mix and match. And the Earth ships are kind of half, it's like if you stuck a rocket up the stern of a wet Navy ship.
Yeah. I mean, the main ship, the Yamato, is basically literally that in the original. Mm-hmm. And so Drew, why don't you go ahead, since we've talked about like kind of the design ideas, we keep mentioning that, and we're only, a few minutes into our podcast, but why don't you go ahead and give the background for the Yamato series, the first season plot.
Okay. Now, when we're talking about Yamato, we're bringing up Matsumoto, but he was technically a hired gun, a very important hired gun, but still a hired gun. Yoshinobu Nishizaki was the creator, producer, etc. And the plot that they came up with was that an alien invader would show up, bombard the Earth into the surface of the Earth into a radioactive wasteland after destroying the entire Earth military. And the only solution would be a mission. There would be a message from space, to quote another movie that would come out a little bit later, which would be, if this is the Shitsugumi in space, message from space is the Hakiden in space, if I remember right. There would be a message from a far-off planet saying, I have a machine that can fix your planet, you just have to come here and get it. And since they'd lost all their other ships, they were going to rebuild the wreck of the Yamato, since the oceans have been boiled off now, and it's quite easy to get at. And in this continuity, it hadn't broken in half, which the actual wreck, it was blown in half actually, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, at the time, so at the time it was not known that the Yamato was in pieces.
It was known. There are photos of the explosion. The explosion was heard and seen all the way back on Kyushu.
Yeah, but it wasn't confirmed by the wreck.
True. Nobody had dived on the wreck yet.
Yeah, we had no idea what the. We had no idea at the time it was written, which is one of the things they corrected later on, and we'll get to that. they had no idea what the condition of the wreck was because of the main concept behind the whole, hey, let's rebuild this thing as a spaceship.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, the ship is rebuilt, fitted with an engine, the blueprints of which are conveniently included in the message from space, and a crew of the last hope of humanity, the last people left in the Navy, and various volunteers are stuffed aboard, and they have 1 year to get all the way out, pick this thing up, and come all the way back.
It's a fetch quest to win a war.
Yeah, it's a fetch quest to win a war, which is not how wars really work, but it makes a great plot. We will say that. And so it's very episodic because it's basically the Yamato approaching X planet, it takes a good half a dozen episodes to get out of the galaxy. Sorry, to get out of the solar system. Then they start warping across the galaxy towards Iskandar, which is the planet that they're trying to reach. And meanwhile, the Gamelons, who are the bad guys, who are a bunch of green-skinned, white-haired, evil aliens, led by Deslar, or Deslock in the English adaption, are doing everything in their power to stop them. And it is very front-loaded. I saw almost the entire thing when it was first broadcast in the U.S., and I believe they got to Iskandar about 6 episodes from the end. If that. It might have been 4 episodes from the end. It's very much the journey there. It's very much there and back again, but the back again is not nearly as complicated as the front end. I think Tolkien had a longer back again in his book than they did. So, again, it's a enormous fetch quest. The Yamato goes out, gets shot at, beaten up, and every episode ends with, hurry, you only have X number of days left.
And we've got a ticking clock going on.
Yeah, we have a ticking clock going on. The ship is blown to halfway to atoms half the time. It's been joked that the Yamato must have been towing another copy of itself behind because there's no other way they could have kept fixing it. It's kind of crazy. It's really cool. And I will say that there's a certain sense of fatalism and duty, and although some of the crew get homesick and there's a certain sense of hopelessness and how can we go faster because they're still trying to figure out the two big MacGuffins that help the ship are the wave motion engine, which is the plans they got from Iskandar, which is an engine that actually makes this journey feasible and is basically spread down the core of the old Yamato hull, and the infamous wave motion gun, which is a spinal mount cannon, which is basically the engine venting forward.
Yeah, and it's
to end all beam guns. If you've ever played StarCraft, you know about this because they call it the Yamato gun in StarCraft. That's exactly where it comes from.
There's a lot of games and stuff that have actually used it, and we're going to be comparing a lot, talking a lot about the two Western Star franchises, which is Star Trek and Star Wars, during this episode. So a thing to note is that this show does predate that whole massive canon, predates the Death Star by 2-3 years. 1974 is when the TV series came out.
Yeah, so 2 years.
Yeah. I guess it's like two and a half. Two and a half, if you're counting.
There is some question, but there big cannons on spaceships is a pretty common sci-fi trope.
But yeah.
Yes, the whole firing of the wave motion gun procedure is a very involved thing. Everybody puts on glass, on welder's goggles. This little gun sight pops up in front of the first officer so you can aim the entire ship. It's a really involved procedure. It's not quite the form-blazing sword a la Voltron, but it's pretty darn close.
we've talked about launch sequences before on this show. It's a launch sequence for the canon, basically. And the series has got a lot of really good, good. Now, you mentioned the Gamelon. So one thing I actually want to notate is in the original show, at least, remember, they don't start off blue.
That's true. I think
they start off just looking like humans in space. And then by about 10 episodes in is when we revealed, oh, by the way, the Gamelons are actually blue. And we'll be talking about another entry in this franchise later on in the episode and a few things that they use. There's a lot of inconsistencies in this early one.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it is because it really, like, as we said, Matsumoto was a hired gun on this to the point, but he also took a lot of ownership of it to the point where there's actually now two different Yamato continuities.
Mm-hmm.
One off of Matsumoto's and one off of Yoshinobu.
Yeah.
Off his ideas.
Yes.
For Yamato. And
Yoshinobu, it should be noted, as I recall, was borrowing some of the same writers from the Yakuza series Battles Without Honor and Humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Which are famous Yakuza pictures, but are not known for being the most clear things ever put on celluloid. In fact, they're famously opaque in a lot of ways. So, again, lots of style, but not necessarily a lot of continuity or a lot of, you know, properly buried subplots or anything like that.
Now, the funny thing is I was doing a little bit of reading, getting ready for this, and apparently the wave motion gun is not original to Yamato.
Is that an Adragon thing?
Sexeroid.
Sexeroid.
An erotic comedy manga, which Matsumoto wrote in 1968.
Oh, so it's a Matsumoto thing.
It is still a Matsumoto thing.
Okay.
It's just, I found when I was doing some research at rstarblazers.com, a article from July 3rd, 2013. It was an interview with Matsumoto, and he actually mentioned that Sexroid apparently is where the wave motion gun came from.
Almost sexual, isn't it, Smithers?
Yeah, I'm like, that makes me go, did George Lucas ever find that manga?
Probably not. There's some debate. There's a fair amount of debate if Lucas was in Japan in 74 and 75, and there's always been
debate. Might have seen it on his hotel television.
He might have turned the TV on and caught it.
Caught some of it.
Yeah.
Just not know what it was.
Yeah, he wouldn't have. I mean, it's right. It's space opera. Space opera.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about space opera is most space opera looks like other space opera.
And that's very true, especially when you think of space opera anime.
You got your little spaceships. You got your pew pew laser guns.
Yeah.
And first season came out, and this is a notable thing. It didn't get shortened. It ran all the way to the end. It was quite successful. There was a compilation movie made. There was a second season made, which was The Comet Empire, where a new baddie appeared that is even worse than our previous baddies. And now Deathlock is working for the other baddies, but kind of working with the humans too. He's becoming a much more sympathetic character. And then the third season, which is The Bowler Wars, which nobody talks about.
We don't talk about the Bowler Wars.
The second season is famous for the massive body count that it has, especially the movie version. Farewell to Space Battleship Yamato or Arrivederci Yamato.
Arrivederci. So, fun story about Arrivederci Yamato. Mm-hmm. And by fun, I mean, my first introduction to Yamato was I was at Colossal Con 2008, I believe it was.
Don't ask me.
It was 2007 or 2008. I was just trying to remember if it was before I graduated or after I graduated, because Colossal Con was in June or late. It was in June, and it was after the school year. And I was wandering around. I walked into one of the video rooms, and I caught the end of Arrivederci Yamato with the fucking body count.
That's like watching X, like watching the last two episodes of X by Clamp.
Yeah, it's like, this would mean something if you had been here since the beginning.
What's the bit from, it's that bit from Heavy Metal in the bit with John Candy.
He dies,
she dies,
yeah,
everyone dies. And that's pretty much how, I mean, and that is when we say space opera, there you have to kind of emphasize the opera for two reasons. One, because yeah, there's going to be a body count. A lot of people are not going to do not make it out of the movies or the TV series alive in one way or another. And two, it should be noted, the other operatic thing is, well, the theme song, which is legendary. It is almost, but not quite, Japan's second national anthem.
It's practically the unofficial. So many people know how the U.S. Navy, its official song is Anchors Away.
Yes, which is kind of boring.
Unofficially, the official song of the Maritime Self-Defense Force is the Yamato March.
To which I say the Japanese have a better idea. We need to write some new lyrics and borrow it. Now, you can go on YouTube and find American military bands playing the Yamato March for visiting Japanese ships.
Yeah.
This is a song that has an incredible, I would say, here's the other thing that's interesting about Yamato as a series is it had non-fandom cultural penetration. It is one of those things that almost anybody would be expected to know about. Almost everybody knows that damn theme song. Almost everybody knows at least a bit about how the plot works.
It's one of those series.
In the first episode of Aritsiatsura, when they draft Ataru to play tag with the alien princess, he says, "No, I'd rather be dragged off to Iskandar." That's how deep of an impression. That was only 4 years on. So this is a seminal work. And again, this had pop culture, not just anime culture, penetration. Now, it had a lot of influence on anime going forward. Certain series owe a lot directly to it, and several owe quite a bit indirectly to it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's notable because this is one of those big Japanese shows that everybody knows. In Japan, at least.
Yeah.
And if you're a sci-fi fan in America, you know the theme song.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things with the theme song is and we've seen other series which have gotten like reboots and stuff and, you know, new installations. Installments. And they've had their completely unoriginal theme song. Even a show with as much legacy as Cutie Honey has come down to this where they didn't have the theme song in like the most recent version. Every single version of Yamato that I have seen has used that theme song and does not stray far from the original version. Very similar arrangements, maybe some slightly different orchestration. Good example is in some of the more recent ones, we've had bigger orchestra, which has made a huge difference in like the sound quality. There's actually, and a lot of times they use the same guy. Apparently the same guy has been singing the Yamato theme for like 45 years.
Well, you need a guy with a pretty good it's pretty much baritone range. It's
baritone because I can sing it pretty well.
Yeah, I can handle it pretty well. I can handle the English version. Japanese version, I could probably sight read. I always wanted to do a duet version with a Japanese speaker and then trade off halfway through.
You want to know how iconic that theme is? My mother-in-law watched Star Blazers when she was a kid. My wife and I were sitting in the car. We were picking up dinner, I think, one night with her. And this was back when my wife and I were both in college. And we pulled up one of the versions of the theme song. And she started singing it. Mm-hmm. And we were like, how do you know that? Like, she had mentioned it before, but she, like, because we had Star Blazers had recently gone up on Netflix,
mm-hmm.
The English version, and she caught us watching some of it. She's like, "Yeah, I remember watching this with a kid." But we pulled that up, and she started singing remembering the lyrics, and it had been like probably at that point easily probably 20, 25 years since she would have last seen it.
Yep. Well,
it's one of those kind of songs.
I remember it, and it's been a long time since I've. I will say this, the other thing that tells you how much cultural penetration it had even in the U.S., do you know what the jargon file is, Rick?
I do not, actually.
It's kind of TV tropes for computer nerds. It's an online dictionary of various bits of historical computer trivia. Remember, Ryan, remember the story of Mel, the guy who was programming the blackjack program?
Mm-hmm.
He was supposed to have it let the customer win, and he made it so that the customer lost instead, and the other guy had to try to fix it?
Yes.
That's in the jargon file.
Gotcha.
There's a lot of things in the jargon file. I can barely understand half the shit that's in the jargon file. But somewhere in the jargon file, there is a song called Science Majors. But there's a song listed on the jargon file called Science Majors, which is, of course, parody of the English version of the Amato theme song, which, of course, is called Star Blazers. What was it? Evil graviators, evil laughs, how do we read all these graphs? We must be accurate, our error not too great. And this is the same for computer nerds in the early 80s. So, you know, this is obscure shit, but we'll get to that when we talk about Star Blazers. This had major cultural penetration in Japan, and quite a bit in the U.S. It's kind of scary when you find out just how many people remember the damn theme song.
Well, now, I do think we did mention a body count in the movies. I think that we should probably move on at this point and talk. We've talked a little bit about the general setup of both the, you know, of the seasons that everyone kind of remembers that's seen the show, and move on to the, well, the bodies that need to be counted.
First is our bad joke. We're going to just use Japanese names, huh?
Let's stick with Japanese names because at this point, I know them better than I know the English ones.
Okay, so our major character is Kodai. Kodai is our young adult, you know, kind of not total rebel, but definitely angry young man character.
He's a very typical 70s anime shonen slash giant robot protagonist in a not giant robot show.
Yeah, he's got standard Japanese protagonist
hot-bloodedness
written all over him, no doubt about it. His most notable thing that features in this one is his parents are dead, so he's an orphan, so we don't have to deal with that. But there's a definite tension between him and the captain. Because he is not the captain. He is the weapons officer. He's first officer in charge of weapons. We have he's our lead. One of the, you know, if they don't really mention it, but he's technically a watch officer. You know, he's in charge of the gunnery department.
He's a tactical officer.
Wave motion gun. He gets to run around and deal with all the violence and everything else. The interesting part is that the captain, who is, you know, looks like every old captain you've ever seen in any movie. Captain Okita, who has a big full white beard, Father Neptune bit, you know.
He's like Santa in a Navy uniform.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. Is that there's a certain amount of tension between them because Kodai's older brother was serving in the Navy that tried to stop the Gamelons in the first when they first came into the solar system and died. His ship was shot down and he died while under Okita's command. And here's an interesting touch that the Japanese adopted from Star Blazers, believe it or not. In the original one, he basically just was Kodai's big brother was just determined to go down fighting, very Japanese, and took the Yukikaze, named after yet another famous Japanese ship, into close action with the Gamelons and lost and died. In Star Blazers, he specifically states that he's covering the Admiral's retreat.
Yeah, he's doing the heroic sacrifice.
Yes.
As the West really kind of understands a heroic sacrifice.
The interesting thing is when they redid the animation in 2099.
Yes.
They adopted that plot instead of.
Yeah, it was one of the things plot. They kind of modernized some things. We'll talk more about 2199 later, but yeah, it's there's some stuff that they modernize, and as you mentioned, characters will also notate this as well, because they're straight up characters that are non-existent in the original series that play a major role in 2199 to help. Yeah. Basically, they take some characters' things away from them and move them to these new characters. We'll get to that very particular when we speak about one of the characters in in a little bit.
In a couple of minutes. But the important thing is, yeah, it's you have to remember that Star Blazers, for all of its weird dialogue and attempts to cover up stuff, also, there is a certain amount of feedback between the two of them. And the Japanese were aware of what was changed. And in some cases, they did. And as you said, as we've said, Matsumoto went for the international crew bit a lot more than his counterpart did. So we have the old captain, the hot-blooded young watch officer. Technically, I don't remember if he's the first officer, because his best buddy, Shima, or Mark Venture, to use the English name, the guy in the green suit is his, you know, best buddy for most of the movie. For most of the show, and he is, you know,
Daisuke Shima.
Yeah, Daisuke Shima, and he's the calm part to Kodai's anger, or Wildstar, which is kind of a little too on the nose.
Typical '80s character name for Star Blazers there.
Well, especially right after Star Wars came out, you're gonna get this kind of thing happening in that, and they are. Those two are sort of the best buddies, standard counterpart.
They're
the standard basics. However, then there's the third officer, who's sort of our Spock analog.
Well, isn't you're talking about Sanada, right?
Sanada is.
He's actually the first officer in the 2199 series.
Yeah,
I think
in the 2199 one, they actually fit it together.
Yeah.
Technically, what it is if you have a ship like that, you would have three watch officers, which would mean they would do four-hour shifts on the bridge, relieving each other. And, you would end up doing 8 hours on the bridge every day, 8 hours sleeping, and 8 hours taking care of paperwork and all the other crap you had to get done.
Yeah. It was in the Royal Navy, it was the first, second, and third officer.
Yes. There's it's executive officer. Well, first officer or executive officer also has the job of being the guy in charge of the crew.
Yeah.
Because the captain's job is not to run the crew.
He runs the ship.
Job is to run the ship. And the captain does not have a fixed schedule. So, okay, enough of that. Everybody knows that I've read the Cruelty a few too many times and absorbed all that. And everything, but Sanada is the cool one. He's very, very, very calm. Very, very Spock-like. Really,
yeah, about as Spock-like as you can get without having the complete alienness of Spock.
Yes, but he's bionic, so there is that. It's like he's had total limb replacement. He's about as Spock-like as you can get and still be human. And, guess who voiced him in season 3?
Who?
René Arbejanon.
Really?
Yes!
He got voiced by Odo?
Odo.
And oh my god.
Or Sidney Freeman, for that matter, if you're an old MASH fan.
Yeah,
it's but yes. Yeah, so that's a little bit out there, but that's like the core officer set, and then there's the chief engineer, who's the gruff older guy who's in charge of running. You know, he's not a terribly important character. The doctor is mostly notable for being affable and drunk most of the time. There's Analyzer, who looks like a ripoff of R2-D2, but is actually probably more of a riff on Robbie the Robot, since he precedes R2-D2.
Yeah, it's another thing kind of where some people are... It's another case where you're wondering, did George Lucas see this on TV when he visited Japan?
No, because he's already said where he got R2-D2 from. Same place he got C-3PO from. Hidden Fortress.
That's true. Well, I mean, for the idea of a vaguely trash can shaped robot.
I'd say Robbie the Robot, some of the other bits.
Okay.
Some of the 50 science fiction robots probably are the more likely source. So there's the doc, who's a drunk. There's the engineer, who's not too terribly important. There's Yuki, who is the only woman on the ship in the entire dang show.
Yes, Yuki Mori is the only female character on board. The original show.
She's like your perfect woman character. Very motherly. Does all the nursing. Is the nurse.
She's Yamato Nadeshiko.
Yeah, she's Yamato Nadeshiko. Which, we'll get to that joke a little bit later.
Yeah. We will.
But she wears so many hats it wouldn't be funny as to what her bit is. But she is basically there to give a feminine presence on the ship.
Somebody, I was also like to point out she's the only character of the crew that's not wearing bell bottoms in the original.
That's true. They're all wearing those Star Blazers and Legion of Superheroes in the 70s are the two series that I always associate with bell bottoms. And they are both roughly contemporary with each other. Who doesn't have bell bottoms on their uniform? Oh, Homer. Homer doesn't. Kato.
Oh.
Kato doesn't. Kato is the pilot.
He's a pilot, so he wears a jumpsuit most of the time.
Yeah, he wears a jumpsuit. I think I'm thinking Sonata, Homer. I know him as Homer. That's my problem. He's a fairly minor character. He wears he's the other character who wears yellow and black. He's the communications officer. And I could never remember what his Japanese name, because he's not very important.
No.
He's one of the major, okay, Kato. Yes, and again, Saburo Kato. Okay, I see what you did there. You know what Saburo means, right?
No.
Third son.
Ah.
Okay, now... Who is one of the most famous Japanese fighter pilots to survive World War II?
Oh, that'd be Saburo Sakurai. Sakai. Sakurai is a different... Yeah, Saburo Sakai.
Saburo Sakai.
Who I believe they actually confirmed that one of the Flying Zeros is actually one of his.
I think.
I'd have to check on that.
But Kato, is one thing. But we get to another show, there'll be a pilot named Sakai, but it'll be Jiro Sakai. Jiro being second son. But we'll get to that show later on.
Yes, we will.
But just little things. There's always these little touches of Japanese naval stuff that gets tucked in there. The other character that we probably have to bring up is Saito.
Yes, the Marine.
Is he a sergeant or a captain? I can never remember if he's an officer or a
man. It might depend, to be honest, it might depend on the series.
Yeah, he acts like a sergeant, but he might, considering how many troops he's leading, he might be a captain.
He could be a platoon sergeant.
Which would be,
possibly.
And, or Knox, to give him his English name. And he is... important because he's sort of the big guy. If there's a five-man band on the Yamato, and there isn't really, but there kind of is, he's the big gruff guy. And he only has a handful of episodes where he's at all important. But he does sort of dominate one of them. One of the important things the TV series did, even between TV series, is there was a certain amount of continuity. Because there is a episode... I don't remember if it's the end of the second season, end of the first season, or at some point it's in the second season because Captain Okita or Captain Avatar is no longer with them.
Yeah.
And they pass by the same planet that they picked up Saito and the rest of his troops off of when they were getting their butts kicked by a whole bunch of Gamelon tanks.
So the reason why you were confused, Drew, is in the original series, Saito was a company commander, so officer. In 2199, he's a sergeant major.
Okay. In either case, he's a company commander, effectively.
Sergeant
major is a field first. That's the guy who works under a captain and scares the shit out of the platoon sergeants, who scare the shit out of the lieutenants.
Yeah.
But otherwise, he's a captain, which makes him a Marine major, because no ship can have two captains, as we've had this discussion before. You get a courtesy promotion.
Yeah. You get a courtesy promotion, even though said captain is four or three ranks below a naval captain.
Right. But you can't use the term.
No.
At least in certain navies. Certain navies do it, certain navies do not. American Navy most certainly does not. So, does not have multiple captains. So, yeah, you get your courtesy promotion. Anyway, that was the first time I ever ran into, because he actually goes out with a bottle or two of spring water in the U.S. one, sake in the other one. Doesn't really matter. He goes out with a bottle and basically starts pouring one for the homies on a bunch of helmets on rifles, of which there are quite a few of them lying around that planet. And then some other troopers show up with more tanks and disturb him, much to their regret. But I remember that episode. I saw that when I was like 9 years old. I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen in my life. So, yeah, but he's not really important in 90% of the episodes. He's just there. Of course, he's, you know he's doomed.
Yeah.
So, yeah, sooner or later. And you have, as I said, Saburo Kato and the Black Tiger Squadron, who are the onboard guys who get dumped off the back of the, dumped out of the bottom of the ship to fight off all of the Gamelon destroyers and everything else. One of which is not prominent until the second season is notable for a hairstyle where it grows basically all the way down over one eye, which is notable for a couple reasons. One, because I tried to grow my hair that way when I was a kid. I thought that was terribly cool. Two, it looks very familiar for something that one of Matsumo's assistants, who also has been Tuckerized somewhere into the crew, borrowed for one of his series
that we've spoken about before.
Yeah, that's Yamato.
Yeah.
Sorry, not Yamato, Yamamoto.
Yeah, Yamamoto.
Yamamoto, who we'll talk about what happened to him in the later series a little bit later, but he's sort of the, I don't know, he's a mauve shirt, I would say, because he's just one of the pilots, but he's one of the pilots that you actually can recognize.
But it's kind of interesting because, in a way, he gets a bigger role in 2199.
Yes.
A much bigger role.
In a certain way. But we'll get to that in a minute. But they're launched out the bottom. On occasion, they also have two man fighters that are launched off of essentially what are the catapults for the Yamato for the seaplane.
Aren't those ones kind of like scout ships?
Yeah, they're scout ships. They're the analogy.
Which is what those catapults were used for. They're used for scout aircraft.
Correct. Although they don't really show where the hangar is. Well, technically, the hangar was below the deck originally.
Yeah.
But again, you have a pretty basic company ship. You have your wild young hero who's basically being broken in to be the captain because it's becomes pretty obvious that that Okita is not going to make it through the whole series.
No.
He is old.
You tell kind of from the beginning, he's the mentor that's meant to not make it to the end.
He's got Obi-Wan written all over him.
Mm-hmm.
He's definitely got disposable mentor writ large on him, and famously dies towards the end of the first season. So the second season, he actually isn't even there. He's a known presence.
Yeah.
But that would be about it. Let's see. Now, the other character, there's, of course, Starship Iskandar, the nice lady who's helping us in all of this. We only see for like two episodes when they tip some things. But there is one other character who must be remarked upon because he's fairly important. He's very important for the series, and I maintain he's very important going forward.
And that would be?
Deslar, a.k.a. Deslock.
Our main antagonist for the first season. Our
central antagonist for the first season. And the secondary antagonist.
Yeah, it a recurring pain in the ass in the second.
Yes. And he is your classic, you know, young officer, magnificent bastard type. He is always after the Yamato. He is utterly ruthless.
While also being the leader of the Gamblers.
But he is, he frankly oozes style.
He does.
And he also has a famous chant that's associated with him in the English version. By the way, folks, there is a somewhere on the internet, in fact, I'm pretty sure still on YouTube, there is a gentleman who did some very early fan work, published one of the earliest fanzines in America. He is also the source that I am quoting when I mention the tales of the G.I. Joe movie, amongst other things. He had a number of stories attached to him, but he famously showed up at AnimeCon 1 and at one point cosplayed as Deathlok. Not Deslar, Deathlok, because we were that type of fans at the time. He had a very nice, you know, cut together from an old Imperial German Army uniform setup. And he gives a famous speech that you can see him doing, which includes such lines as, "Aren't you supposed to be blue? I lost something in the translation."
If you're curious, it is the third video if you search Deathlok AnimeCon 1.
There's two others besides that?
I mean, it's AnimeCon 91, Deathlok cosplay. Well, the first one is a tribute to the leader Deathlok, and then the second one is a surviving your first convention guide.
Oh, okay. But the third one, for reference, when the crowd is chanting, I am off to the speaker's right and about 5 to 10 feet behind the camera that's shooting him. Yeah, I was in that room for that bit. And he also has the other bit of, "People ask me, why did you become a maniacal world-conquering dictator?" Cue the audience. "Why did you become a maniacal world-conquering dictator?" "Thank you. You may live." You haven't seen that one, Rick? I thought I forced everybody to watch that one at some
point. You might have forced it on me a long time ago. Okay. And I've watched so much. I've rotted so much of my brain with YouTube. I just can't remember it.
Okay. Well, at some point you got to watch it again. Cause yeah. But again, what's the important point of Deathlok or Deathlar?
He's basically he's the Gamelon leader.
Beyond that, he has one very Matsumoto-ish quality that really informs anime going forward.
Well, I'm sure it's not him holding a snifter of brandy, is it?
Nope. It's that towards the very end of Kamen Empire, he starts to help the Yamato crew.
Oh, so you're saying is Matsumoto is who we can blame for all of the villain retribution arcs that we get nowadays?
Sort of.
Can In you everything.
Speak? Okay, let me put it this way. I would claim that without Deathlok, we never had Char.
Where he sort of starts to help, but he never stops being a bastard?
Yeah. Char is a highly evolved Deathlok.
I mean, he's even blonde like Deathlok.
They could be brothers! One of them got stuck in the tanning bed a little too long.
I don't want to know what tanning blood turns you blue.
Who knows? The point being, they're very similar characters. They don't have quite the same role in this show, but you can draw a line from Char straight back to Deathlok, but you can't draw a line past Deathlok and really run in. There's nobody in Gatchaman in the villain group that has that much style, for instance. And the villains in Go to Guy's stuff, well, they're weird, but they're not magnificent. So, yeah. Deathlok is a big deal. And it's kind of quiet because, you know, when you see him, it's like, yeah, we've seen this guy 20 gazillion times. Yeah, well, this is the first time we really saw this guy. This was a big deal that we added in somebody to interrupt our there and back, you know, put a face on the enemy to make our there and back work. and a conflicted bad guy, because by the second, you know, by the second series, he doesn't have a home planet anymore.
Nope.
Because the Yamato guys kind of wrecked it.
Yeah.
On their way through.
Oops, was that us?
Yeah. It was a nice home planet you got. Shame if something happened to it. That was the other thing that there's a certain plot twist that the Japanese spoiled in episode 3, and the Americans were smart enough to keep secret the whole damn time.
What was that? We won't
break it. What?
Oh, we're not going to break it. Never mind then. I couldn't remember.
I'll tell you at the end of this.
That's fine. So yeah, I mean that covers like most of the characters. There's some other ones. There's one we missed, even though she's not much of a character because she's more of a plot device, and that would be Sasha.
Starsha, yeah.
No, Sasha, not Starsha.
Depends on which version.
Well, no, Starsha's the one that's alive.
Oh yeah, Sasha's the
dead woman in the tube.
The dead girl in the tube with the voicemail attached to her.
Yeah, unfortunately, Yamato kind of starts off with a woman in a refrigerator.
Mm.
Whoops.
It
was the 70s.
Yamato is very testosterone. It's deeply romantic, but it's very much a boys' club.
The original has a kind of a case of testosterone poisoning at some points.
A little bit. The fact that the Matsumoto stuff sort of brings in the romantic side, so it doesn't become quite so testosterone poisoned. I would think that Blue Noah and Odin down the road probably have it worse.
Yeah, I'd say Odin definitely has it worse.
So here's the thing. It came out in 74. Mm-hmm. It was pretty damn big. After Star Wars, they brought it out. They made a movie out of it, and it made even more money than Star Wars, which is kind of scary.
Yeah, Yamato's one of those series that is kind of... If you're in anime sci-fi circles, Yamato kind of never died.
Nope.
It always had... a great example is there's the Super Robot Wars games, and the Yamato has been in the games multiple times.
Because Yamato has always been in the pop cultural zeitgeist in Japan, mm-hmm. and pretty near the pop cultural zeitgeist in America for, you know, having been that one TV series, because people remember it. And I think I said once upon a time, Gatchaman had more Fen fans and is an more interesting thing for the in-between stuff, but Yamato, and to a lesser extent the other Matsumoto stuff, was what was keeping anime tied to sci-fi for the longest time.
Yeah, and the thing was, you would see Yamato come up, you know, every so often, and not only was it still in the zeitgeist, but Yamato was one of those shows where you kind of kept getting either new installments or reimaginings for a while. None of them really caught on a bunch. No. If I remember correctly, there was, you had, so the last of the original ones was Final Yamato. That was 1983. Mm-hmm. And then Nishizaki attempted to make a sequel in 1994, which was Yamato 2520.
Basically kicked off the legal action between him and Matsumoto.
Yes.
That kept...
It only has...
Nishizaki had already... tried to do Blue Noah, Odin, and I think there was one other one beyond that.
Yeah.
He had attempted to redo the same general story idea without Matsumoto two or three times and failed rather miserably. At some point, we're going to talk about Odin, because Odin is remarkable.
Now, what's interesting, as I'm reading this, by the way, is that so Nishizaki apparently was the winner of that lawsuit.
Yeah.
So essentially anything now, what I still just find interesting about it is that when we talk about some of the stuff that's coming up here in a minute, I'd say Matsumoto's style had a much larger impact on it than any of Nishizaki's, you know.
Yeah.
Did, especially when you think about it. But after 2520, you had Matsumoto made a graphic novel in 2000. 2004, there was going to be New Space Battleship Yamato, which Nishizaki was going to, since it was ruled that he legally owned the copyright, He started working on it. That never got going. There was another one, 2004. There was going to be Yamato Resurrection in 2009.
There was discussion of a Hollywood live action version a few times
too. Yes, there was. That one never happened. Never mind. It came out in 2009. Resurrection did come out, but nobody like kind of remembers that one.
Yeah. The remarkable thing was for the longest time, you didn't see Yamato directly. You saw people doing their version of Yamato. Because certain series, to a greater or lesser extent, steal huge chunks of Yamato. And most of them for comedy.
Yes.
To some degree or another. The somewhat quieter one is not quieter as in the show is quiet, but the fact that it's basically Yamato parody is Irresponsible Captain Tyler.
Yes.
Does not wear its Yamato bits on its sleeve to nearly the degree that some of the other stuff does.
It's, you kind of have to know Yamato to get where the references are. A good example is that Tyler's uniform is actually the uniform, or Tyler's uniform is kind of similar to Okita's.
Mm-hmm.
If yeah, I remember correctly.
He wears it very casually.
Yeah, he's got the blue, he's got the if I remember correctly, he's got the long coat.
Yeah, he's got that, and you know, and the crew, some of the crew have the same names. We got another Yamamoto. And as I said, we have a Jiro Sakai instead of Saburo Kato.
Yeah.
Which is, okay, you're doing the same bit. You're just doing it in a different order. Nice try. But it's very much, you know, it's very much on a loose comedy. As I said, there are several times that Aritsuya Atsura references it, but it references it as a pop culture phenomenon.
Yeah, which a lot of them do that, because a good example is Otaku no Video weighs heavily on Yamato imagery. Yes. For some of its, I'm going to call them delusion sequences.
Yeah, some of the dream sequences are very Yamato. I don't know for sure. I think they actually played up the joke to make it work. But the English version of Princess Nine, one of the power hitter character is the daughter of a fisherman, and she had something called the Breaking Waves Swing in the original Japanese.
Let me guess, it got translated to the Wave Motion Swing.
Yes.
That's funnier.
Yes, it was much. Princess Nine is much funnier in the English than it ever is in the Japanese. It's a lot like the other. It's one of the shows where ADV got it for a song, and probably had a better voice cast, and had more fun. You know, had a lot more fun playing with it. Kind of like the other series that owes an awful lot to Yamato, that was dubbed. By ADV, which we will probably cover at some point.
Now, two of the things I think we've talked a little bit about some of its impact.
You got to mention what the other show is first, Rick. What's the other show?
You mean Martian Successor Nadeshiko?
Oh yeah, Martian Successor Nadeshiko has huge chunks of Yamato in it.
Remember when we mentioned that Yamato Nadeshiko thing?
Yes. Not to mention the Yamato Nadeshiko joke, but yeah, the whole it plays into its Ava jokes, but it actually has more Yamato jokes than it does.
Well, it's Ava jokes, it's Macross jokes, it's Yamato jokes.
It's full of fan jokes, but the basic structure is it's a Yamato parody.
Oh crap! I burned it.
Yeah. So. Yeah, Yamato, Martian Successor Nadeshiko, for those of you who aren't up on Japanese horticulture, Nadeshiko is a particularly Japanese flower, usually associated with femininity. So having a battleship named Nadeshiko is kind of weird anyway. It'd be like the battleship Gloriana or something.
Or the battleship Lily.
Lily. Lily, yeah.
Or Battleship Dandelion.
Dandelion, just as long as it's not Pansy. For the record, the British did have a class of ships named after flowers, but they were anti-submarine corvettes. They were a little bit smaller than battleships.
They were.
And for the record, folks,
they were fishing boats with guns on them.
Yeah, they were. They really were. The Japanese men's soccer team is the Blue Samurai. The women's soccer team is the Nadeshiko, or Nadeshikos if you're going into English.
Yeah.
So it's very much a joke to have a Yamato parody with of a ship named Nadeshiko. That just.
Well, and then you take the two titles and mash them together, and you get right. The term for personification of an ideal Japanese woman.
Right. Of which there are none in Nadeshiko.
There's none. There's one in Yamato.
Yeah, there's one in Yamato, but
that's kind of her only character trait in the original series.
Now, very much a bit later, basically after Nishizawa went away, we had a live-action remake.
Well, that was right after the Nishizaka the stuff. That was 2010. It was a year after what was that one I called again? It was right after Resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2010, in December of 2010, they made a live-action Space Battleship Yamato film.
Which is okay, but it's really hard to do a two-hour movie of the whole Nadeshiko, of the whole Yamato story, and have it really work. Because there's so much going on. And in general, it works better as a TV series.
It's also kind of weird because there's a little bit of Hollywoodizing to it, even though it's a Japanese film. The Gamelons are not human. They're like the Borg. They're a hive mind.
Yeah, that's also what they could do with their special effects. And the other problem is it's even more unbalanced in who's the main character, because the guy who's playing
Kodai
is way more famous than anybody else. It's basically, it wouldn't have been made if he wasn't starring in it.
Yeah.
And one, a little too old for the role, and two, it really, he sucks all the oxygen out of the room in a lot of ways.
Now, I do have to say, there is an interesting thing to note with this in the casting, and that's Yuki.
Yeah.
Because you remember the case with Yuki in this one, right?
Yeah, Yuki changes jobs and goes down and becomes a fighter pilot.
Yeah, she becomes a Black Tiger pilot.
She becomes a Black Tiger pilot. The doctor is now female and still a drunk. And the chief engineer looks pretty much like the chief, looks a bit like the chief engineer and a bit like the Bean People doctor guy.
Yeah, I don't know. They somehow managed to pull that off in live action.
They kind of merged the two characters there. And I think they had like, did they have any other female characters besides that? I thought they had like one other.
There was Sato, there was Yuki.
I thought there was one other one, but
There was Aihara.
Mm-hmm. And they had an interest. It works okay, but it has some, it's not great, but it's not bad. And it manages to not give Captain Okita his famous last words, which irritates the shit out of me every time they do that.
Oh, Aihara got gender swapped.
Because
Aihara was originally a male communications officer.
Aihara is Homer.
Yeah.
Aihara is Homer.
There you go.
In Star Blazers.
It's got its interest. It's kind of interesting. Like, if you can find it, like, it's worth watching it at least once.
It won't change your life, but it's not a bad adaption. It's just
get a bowl of popcorn.
Yeah, get a bowl of popcorn. You know, maybe you're gonna make some smart ass remarks, but you're not gonna need the bots to, you know, give it the full treatment.
Yeah.
And then there was when they finally decided to do a live, do another animated, you know, from the ground up remake, which was Yamato 2099.
Yeah, Space Battleship Yamato 2199.
2199,
Or in the original Japanese, Uchen Senkin Yamato ni Ichi Kyu Kyu.
Ichi Kyu Kyu.
They spelled it out.
They just said 2199.
2199. You know, just like Galaxy Express
339.
Mm. Yeah. Now there's a couple things to notice. Oh, I mean,
quit your crying, Q2.
Yeah. What I found interesting about, so one of the things I want to talk about this one is the first thing you notice when you watch 2199 is, it modernizes, but keeps a lot of the classic, like, cause we're so often to think, like, I just actually just rewatched one of my longtime series. And eventually I'll do a podcast on this is Legend of Galactic Heroes. Well, about a year after this one, I think.
Mm.
No, sorry. This was from 2013 is when this originally came out. In 2018, Legend of Galactic Heroes, which was long known as that, oh my God, there's no way this is ever going to get localized and brought over, got localized and brought over, got remade, and the remake got a dub. Yeah, figure that one out. But they changed the aesthetics. Like, everything's modernized in it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
With 2199... they kept, like, they modernized stuff, but they kept a lot of the same feel of the original 70s.
It has a lot of that Aliens / Star Wars /
yeah, like a lot of the stuff still looks
Tetragon. It's got that, you know, very used dirty future look.
Like,
to
they
it.
Sleek stuff. They made stuff, like, they sleeked up stuff. Like, a lot of stuff is slicker looking, you know, in terms of, like, mechanical design and things like that. It's still, like, the strong DNA of the original aesthetic choices are still there in the modern look. Some of the characters are a little bit more modernized in terms of how they look.
They're not, they don't really look like Matsumoto characters, but they're recognizably the same
character. Depending on the character, the Iskandarians, they still look Matsumoto as hell.
That's
the Okita looks exactly the same.
Oh, true. Okita. Yeah.
But you can't really, you know, there's only one way you can really make, you know, Santa Claus in a Navy uniform. I think Analyzer's in it.
Yeah, Analyzer's in there somewhere. I think he's more of a secondary character because he's like a palm pilot in the live action one for most of the show.
Oh, he's CG. He's CG. Yeah, he's CG in the new one, but he's like that cel shaded CG, so it's a little bit less obvious. Mm-hmm. But one of the biggest changes. And we caught this. I don't know how the hell we didn't catch it in the movie when they did a gender flip of Homer. I think it's probably because Homer's less of a major character. Is they flipped Yamamoto.
Yeah.
And she became one of the breakout characters.
Well, the thing was, Yuki is no longer a fighter pilot like she is in the live action one.
No, she's back to her original role.
One of the fighter pilots.
Yeah.
So they gender flipped Yamamoto into a female character. Now, since this was coming out at about the exact same time as a certain American reimagining of a late 70s, early 80s sci-fi property, Akira Yamato, sometimes pronounced Ray, is universally known by American fans by one nickname, by her fan nickname, pretty much exclusively. You know what that is, of course, Rick?
Starbuck,
yeah. Sometimes she's even referred to as having been Starbucked.
Yes.
Because
it's interesting. It's certainly interesting because she really is sort of a breakout character because she gets a couple really important episodes throughout the run of the show.
It helps balance out some of the testosterone and also gives you another character to keep track of in the fighter pilot lines as long as they stay alive. And I would say structurally, it's like a lot of remakes. It doesn't have nearly the issues that, say, the remake of Bubblegum Crisis or the other 21st century remakes of classic anime have had, where you lose so much of the excitement.
I almost would say
plotting, because let's face it, the original Yamato / Star Blazers plotting was all over the place. They were trying to get things done. They were doing it on a budget of practically nothing. Oh, have you ever heard Woodhead's famous thing about the Japanese do it sideways?
No.
Okay, well, I think I may have told you this story to some degree. Japanese were famous for having the art of animation, the Disney official book of the art of animation.
Oh, is this what they do with the multiplane camera?
Yes.
Yeah.
When the Japanese bought their first multiplane cameras... The problem with the Disney-sized multiplane cameras, like 25 feet tall.
You've got to have, it's like 3-4 stories high
to really use it. And a lot of these Japanese studios did not have a convenient room where they could stash something that's, quite frankly, a piece of industrial equipment. So what they would do is they would mount the multiplane camera, which is basically a camera that has different sheets of glass at different distances from the camera, so you can have different things moving at different speeds in kind of fake 3D. If you ever see, like, the trees are moving at one speed, and the next row of trees is moving at another speed, and the clouds are moving at third speed, that's a multiplane camera. And you can have one of them in focus and two of them out of focus, or do a draw-in focus to kind of fake like you're in a 3D world. That's what it's there for. So when the Japanese got a hold of a couple of these and had them built, they tended to build them out horizontally, because that was the only way they could make the damn things fit. Because
then they could put them in like a warehouse.
Yeah, they could put them in the basement or something. They could find a spot in the building that would fit them. But they found out that because of that, it was a lot easier to get at the glass pieces sometimes. And if you've ever seen shots, especially in Yamato, of the Yamato or any other spaceship transiting from, you know, left screen to right screen and getting bigger, and you're wondering, how did they do the scale on that? Well, they didn't really do the scale on that. What they did is they put it on glass at 20 feet, and they shot a few frames. And then they moved it in a couple inches and shot a few frames and kept moving it across and pulling it closer to the camera, few frames at a time. So you could get what looks like perfectly scaling appearing stuff and a ship passing across. Now, it doesn't work in perfect parallax because it doesn't change proportions the way a real ship would.
No, so they draw in this kind of weird squished.
Yeah, they learned how to do it so that you wouldn't notice the fact that the ship is not really a 3D object. But that was, and Yamato is one of the first shows that you really got to see that happening. Now, by this time, they had computers and 20 other things, and it wasn't such a big deal. And Yamato 2199 is, it's a much nicer, cleaner version.
I'd say because it was, they planned, so the way that it released was kind of interesting. It wasn't released as a TV series. It was later re-edited into a TV series. It was originally a series of films that they put in a Japanese theater. So because of this, it's got really big budget.
It's kind of like the Band of the Hawk thing with Berserk when they did the 4-movie series.
Yeah.
But it's better animated than that one is.
But because of that, they're able to take more time on it. They really kind of took, like, I mean, there are differences, but the overall story's the same.
Yeah.
But they were able to take a lot of and comb out. They were able to fine tooth comb or either fix, or in some cases they kept things the same. One of my favorite little details is, so the Gamelons in the original series are just sort of inferred to be a race, you know, on themselves. And then the first Gamelons we see are like normal flesh tones, and then they're blue. They actually explain that in 2199. It's like, well, the Gamelon Empire is actually a bunch of planets that have been like subjugated under, you know, they're part of the Empire, but they're not all the same race. Because the first Gamelons we run to in a 2099, and that's one of the things where when I was watching it with some friends, with Broden and Bear, and our buddy Bear, it was, when we run to the first Gamelons, it's the, I don't remember, I can't remember if they were in the original, I don't think they had this idea in the original series, but I love the idea of it. It's the dimensional submarine.
No, I don't think they had the submarine, because they had basically, the Gamelons for the most part in the first series had those destroyer pillbug things.
Yeah. So they have like this, in this series, they introduce this, they're like, well, we're going to lean more into like kind of the, you know, the World War II-ness of things.
We're
going to do Enemy Below in the middle of our space battleship anime. But it's really kind of cool because it's a,
do it.
Yeah. It's a dimensional submarine. So it like slips between dimensional planes when it quote unquote dives, so it can attack from, you know, instead of doing something like having a ship with a cloaking device, they do something even more batshit insane. But the whole crew is the flesh tone Gamelons. We were like, oh, that's weird. And then we saw Deslar and we're like, wait. And then a couple of episodes later, it's explained, oh yeah, by the way, the Empire is actually made up of many planets. Different planets are going to have different people, you know, that kind of situation. Yeah. It's kind of
first season is generally considered, I think, a lot better than the second season.
I still really enjoyed the second season.
Was it the third season that everybody's...
Third season isn't out yet. It airs this fall.
Okay. Second season seems to have kind of... didn't quite stick the landing to quite...
The second season was a little bit rougher. I feel like with the first season, that you can definitely tell they took their time. Like, I'd almost say that is the definitive Iskandar arc, if you ask me, having seen both arcs, or both versions of that arc. I'd say that 2199 season, or 2199, for in terms of telling the Iskandar story, is a better version of that story. Like, in storytelling, character work, of course, animation.
It's a lot cleaner.
Yeah.
It's a lot better throughout, and it doesn't lose much of the, tell you at the heartstrings romanticism of the original.
It somehow pulls that off without losing any of the charm of the original, but manages to polish what was already there and then fix problems that were... Like, for one example, we're no longer in a ship full of men with one lady. As we mentioned, there's more than just the, Starbucked Yamamoto. You also have is she an intelligence officer?
There's about four notable lady characters and a couple of extras.
Yeah, we've got a nurse. We've got another communication officer. We've got an engineering officer, I think. There's a bunch of characters. And they're not like background characters. They're actual characters. Like, one of them has a fairly major arc in the movie. The actual Yamato 2199 movie.
Yeah. Is that the one that's the Hotel Yamato?
That's the Hotel Yamato one, yeah.
Which...
The weird haunted hotel, kind of. Hotel
Yamato. You can check out anytime you want.
Never leave.
It's almost like a ghost story sort of thing.
It's like a haunted hotel, is the way I describe it.
But, of course, this is sort of this is the Japanese being self-aware about their history.
Yes.
Because the joke was... In the Japanese Navy, the Yamato was known as the Hotel Yamato for two reasons. One, it actually had a reasonable crew accommodations, unlike most Japanese ships. It had hot baths. It had
air conditioning.
Had some air conditioning. Not everywhere, but it had some air conditioning in general. And it had about twice as much room per crewman as most of the other ships in the fleet. But the other reason it was called the Hotel Yamato was it spent about 90% of the war parked in Truk Lagoon, going nowhere.
Yeah.
Because the Japanese were waiting for the final battle, the big decisive battle, and the Yamato, while fairly fuel efficient for its size, still gulped fuel at an alarming rate. So it was rarely worth the effort to fire up the engines and drive it out anywhere.
Yeah, we got to understand about all those old battleships and stuff, and this also goes for like steam engines and things, is unlike your car where you turn a key, it starts burning fuel and you can move immediately, when you're working with a steam powered anything, you have to burn fuel just to get it to the point where it can move. Sometime for if I remember reading correctly, like a battleship, if we're like, okay, Yamato, move out, okay, we'll get right on that in about 1 to 2 days.
Like a couple hours.
With a ship that big to build up steam pressure, it could take up to a whole day to get the fires hot enough.
Yeah, that depended on how much they'd shut down.
Yeah, if it was cold, general, it would take an entire day.
Yeah, if you were just, cold in and were in harbor trim, it would take about 2 hours. Yeah.
But if you'd been an anchor and your crew on leave...
Yeah, that's... If you ever wonder why didn't any of the battleships except Nevada try to get out of Pearl Harbor? Well, Nevada had their engines still warm.
Yeah, the other ones were cold.
The other ones, by the time they got around to getting the engines warmed up, they were underwater for the most part, and it wasn't really worthwhile. So, again, legendary show, although I would say this. No matter how good 2199 is, it's never going to reach the level of...
It won't ever be able to reach the zeitgeist level the original did, partly because it's got a lot more to compete with, and partly because times are changed, tastes are changed. It's not going to hit that same... If Star Wars was to come out, let's say that the original Star Wars was to come out now...
They would have a lot of trouble, although... I will say that episode 7 proved that you could do the original Star Wars and people wouldn't complain too much.
Well, yeah, but it's a case of it already has that reputation of being Star Wars. That's kind of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately for Yamato is that there's been a lot of stuff that's come and gone since then. And as I've mentioned many times, anime just doesn't seem to have the same, like, yeah, you'll have your fans like us, but for the longest time, at least in the West, it didn't seem to have the same hold power on people that a lot of other nerdy outlets in franchises seem to have, like comic books or sci-fi or general sci-fi films, sci-fi books.
Well, anime for the longest time was hard as hell to collect. Hard, it required a college degree to have an idea of what the fuck was going on. And
I don't know, anime, even today with the subtitles and dubs, it's still, you need a college degree to understand what the hell's going on.
Well, part of the thing about learning enough Japanese is that you sooner or later hit the wall where you go, Christ, half of these guys can't write.
And then you watch enough anime and you go, okay, this guy can't, I don't, it's like, no, I don't understand what he's saying, but I can tell he can't act.
Yeah. You get there eventually on some things. But then you get to the converse level where it's like, you know, what was it? Laura used to say that back at club, they were having some discussion about best written anime shows. And she's like, well, what about, you know, Maze on a Koku? And it's like, yeah, that's very well written.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like every line has to mean three different things to three different people.
Yep.
So it's very carefully written. But there are a lot of shows that are... It's kind of like why Tomino can keep trying to top Evangelion, but he still writes like he's writing Gundam.
Yeah, even when he's not writing Gundam.
Even when he's not writing Gundam. And while he writes interesting when he's writing Gundam, he doesn't write necessarily well when he's writing Gundam. He's a far more interesting writer than a good writer.
Well,
but we'll get to that.
I will say that some people say that his best work was Ideon. But do you have anything else? Well, so I would say, just to kind of wrap up a little bit here, you can't really go wrong, I feel, with almost any incarnation of Yamato. Like, some are definitely better than others. 29
is probably the best way to get in.
Yes, $21.99 would be the most accessible. You can find it in the U.S. under Star Blazers $21.99. It is subtitled. It is dubbed.
Those guys held onto that license all those damn years?
I think Funimation picked it up. But I think it's like one of those things where they I think it's possibly whoever, well, let me see who actually released Star Blazers $21.99. Who is doing, Funimation has the, that's right. No, Funimation has it. I think what happened, so Voyager Entertainment has the licensing rights. Mm. And I'm wondering if it's a case of they're using the Star Blazers because they're like, that's probably going to have more penetration.
Cultural penetration. Yeah, people still remember that damn show.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing.
What was it? It was Marcon a few years ago. Me and Drew went to Marcon a few years ago, and we ran three panels. Because Marcon is a sci-fi convention, specifically a sci-fi literature convention, for those of you who do not know. And we were actually invited because they wanted to get some of that sweet, sweet anime convention pie. But they realized they had like no one on staff that really knew anime. So they reached out to the club.
So we did anime and animation.
Yes.
We covered both. We did a historical overview of anime and a historical overview of animation in general.
And I believe...
And how anime kind of tied into
anime
it
was
because...
two parts. Animation was one part. No, anime was one part. Animation was two parts.
Yeah, because animation, we had to. I think we split.
We split basically post or pre-war and post-war.
We split at Sleeping Beauty.
Did we split at Sleeping
Beauty?
Because
that was the high water. Yeah, because that was the high water market.
Yeah, because stuff. Okay.
Trust me, I remember this
kind
of
shit.
You wrote
the damn presentation, so I'd hope you'd remember it. but if you want to get Yamato, I highly recommend Star Blazers $21.99. I like 2202. And 2205 is coming out later this year in Japan. So we can expect to get that probably around late 2022 or maybe early 2023. So do you have anything else to say on Yamato, Drew?
Not really. It's a legend. It's a legend for a good reason. It's pretty basic, but its influence is long, deep, and enduring. And for good reason.
Yeah, I can absolutely agree. And I think with that, we're going to wrap it up. Once again, thank you for joining us this week as we looked into this fairly long episode. We'll be back hopefully in 2 weeks with another episode. We're still working on what that will be, but so it'll be a surprise to you and me. So until next time, I've been Rick.
And I've been Drew.
And remember, someone had to draw that. Yamato!